There's a lot of reasons to scratch in the summertime. Poison ivy, mosquito bites, rashes caused by allergic reactions, and then just basic heat rash. The sensation that makes these small ailments noticeable is the desire to itch the area and experience the sweet relief that follows the act of scratching. I'm Suzanne Hogan, and on this Central Standard, we'll look at the neurological components of itching. What's going on in our brains when we feel the urge to itch, even if it damages our skin and can cause bleeding? And later, we explore the pain and mystery behind migraine headaches. There's little known about this common health issue and the severe pain it causes those who suffer from the headaches. We'll look at the variety of treatments from prescription drugs to psychological and physical remedies, some of which you won't believe. That's all next after this hour's news. Everybody itches. Sometimes it's your head, a mosquito bite, an allergy-ridden nose, or an allergic reaction that has caused a rash. In the summertime especially, it seems like there's a lot of scratching going on between the insects, poison ivy, sweaty skin. Sometimes we don't even notice that we're making a little scratch. We just do it. Good morning. This is Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Suzanne Hogan. It's the Itchy and Scratchy Show. For the first part of the hour, we'll discuss what goes on in our brains when we satisfy an itch with a scratch. Then later on in the hour, a conversation about migraine headaches, recent research, and various treatment options. Our guest for our itching segment, Dr. Peter Smith, a neuroscientist and the director of the Institute for Neurological Discoveries, based at KU Medical Center. He conducts research on the sensory nervous system and investigates mechanisms of pain and itch. Good morning, Dr. Peter Smith.
Good morning, Suzanne.
And by phone, Dr. Lanny Rosenwasser, professor of pediatrics at Children's Mercy Hospital. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, a pleasure to be here.
So, gentlemen, let's start first with the basics here. What's going on in our brain when we feel the sensation to scratch an itch? Dr. Peter Smith?
Right. So, itch is part of a very old system. It's really all about nerves when we're talking about itch. And the itch response is part of a system that's there to protect us. So if you go way back in development, some 500 million years before we even had a brain, some very primitive organisms had something called a nerve net. And that would actually pick up on noxious stimuli, things like temperature and pressure in the chemical environment, that would be aversive to that particular organism. So this is a way that they learn to avoid this and to survive. Fast forward about a half a billion years, and we still have that same system as part of our own nervous systems right now. Of course, we're much more evolved. We have a brain that gives it emotional coloration and cognition. But we still have these defensive systems in place. So some of them are involved in the obvious things like heat and pressure. And those allow us to take aversive measures. So if something is too hot, for example, we put our finger on a stove, we can remove our finger very quickly. So that protects us. But in terms of other organisms that might like to take advantage of us, for example, insects, fleas, mosquitoes, whatever, they land on us and they want to make a very nice meal of our tender tissues and our fluids. And so they are actually become part of us if they actually get into the skin area. So to remove those, we can't simply withdraw. We need to do something else. And that something else is a very complex action of scratching.
So there is a relationship between what's going on in our brain and similar things with pain. Is there a relationship between itching and pain?
Right. They're very closely related systems. As a matter of fact, until several months ago, we thought they were, at least some people thought, that they were the same system. And that low levels of pain gave rise to itch, and higher levels of pain gave rise to a sensation to scratch. From recent evidence, we now know that there is a separate subset of neurons, of nerve cells, that actually mediate the scratch reflex. And so these are a little more evolved. They evolved somewhat later than the overall heat and pain sensing pathway, and they're responsible specifically for that itch response.
Dr. Lanny Rosenwasser, you're a professor of pediatrics in the allergy and immunology division. There's a lot of things related to allergy that cause itch. Can you talk about that?
Sure, I'd be delighted to. As Professor Smith pointed out, One of the ways in which the body gets acclimated to provide responses to foreign invasion is through this neuropathic and neurogenic reflex system in terms of itch and scratch, etc. But one of the other ways in which the body provides host defense is through immune reactions. And one of the common immune reactions associated with itch is our allergic reactions in a variety of circumstances where we make reactions to things like pollen or foods or latex or even medications or other drugs that we might take for other things, and as well as in more serious kind of allergic-based disorders in the skin, such as atopic dermatitis or eczema, or chronic urticaria or hives or psoriasis, bullous formation in the skin. The immune system is intimately involved in these reactions, some through allergic mechanisms and some through straight immunopathologic reactions. As far as the allergic reactions go, a variety of mediators are produced that can have different effects on different receptors in various target tissues. Some of that may be in the skin, but some of that may be in nervous tissue, in the peripheral nervous system, and even through a variety of mechanisms, central effects in terms of CNS with first initiation by allergic mediators. The major allergic mediator involved in this is histamine. That has a series of actually four major receptors on various tissues that generate responses. And we actually have had drugs for a number of years that block the specific reactions of histamine with specific receptors. So the prominent receptors involved in itch are H1 receptors, although the H4 receptors may play a role as well. And the H2 receptors for histamine, for example, are on stomach cells and can influence the production of stomach acid and a variety of other physiologic responses. So there's really a major interwoven network involved in a lot of these different kinds of responses. One of the interesting findings in the last few years has been the identification of an immune-based protein, an interleukin, known as interleukin 31, that's produced in skin cells in patients with atopic dermatitis. And that has been shown in animal models where mice have it overexpressed to mediate a lot of itch. So there's a lot of new interest, especially in the more serious immune allergic diseases where itch plays a role, where perhaps interceding with this interleukin 1 might influence
itch. It's been kind of called an anti-itch molecule, and there is a study, and they reported this on NPR. Peter Smith, could you kind of review what the study showed us about itching?
Right. So the study involved looking at the specific pathways, the specific nerves that are involved in mediating itch. And we have different types of nerves with different types of transmitters. It turns out that they did a sort of a very broad screening and found a particular molecule in the subset of neurons that we've only been associating in the past with formation of urine. It's released by the heart. It's called a natriuretic peptide. And it turns out that in order for us to feel itch, we need to have this particular peptide in place. It actually, what it does is it takes the messages that Dr. Rosenwasser was talking about in the periphery, the interleukins, histamine, and the nerve cells then that project to the skin carry this information to the spinal cord. And for them to talk to the neurons in the spinal cord, they have to have this particular peptide in place. If you knock that out, then you don't have any itch response.
So these mice that were missing this anti-itch mm-hmm. molecule just did not scratch.
They scratched very, very little.
But right? They still scratched.
Well, for all intents and purposes, they didn't scratch.
We're talking about itching. This is Central Standard on KCUR. Later in the hour, we're going to rotate neurologists and talk about migraines. Do you have an itch you can't scratch? If you have questions about the science of itching, give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or send us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. So there's generalized itch and local itch. What's the difference? Dr. Rosenwasser?
Oh, sure. Well, localized itch makes sense from the point of view of the inciting agent. If you know what the inciting agent is, you can maybe identify it, and it can be present in the skin from a foreign object in which an immune or allergic reaction is based, or it could be internally based, an autoimmune basis for some of the aspects of some itching. It's not only in the skin. There's itching in the nose, obviously associated with allergic rhinitis, itching in other kinds of areas, in the eyes with conjunctivitis when allergens hit the conjunctival membrane on the eyes, and in pollen season, a lot of people have a lot of complaints related to that. Most of those responses are related to histamine, but itch is probably a complex biologic trait, and there are probably many more functions than just one or two that really control itch. So natriuretic peptide is a good example, perhaps, of one of the potential triggers. Another would be interleukin-1, and you'd be looking for ways eventually to sort of block all of them if you possibly can to control itch at its root cause. A central itch is a little bit different. I think some of that may be a perception of itch because there are other things going on in the central nervous system or even in the peripheral nervous system that tricks the brain or the nervous system into thinking that there's a trigger that's causing itch. So like, that becomes more complex.
Are there parts that you scratch more that you just don't even know, like your head, or and maybe there's nothing really going on that's that deep there? It's just
from a peripheral trigger, you know, the people who have the best model, I think, is the eczema models, and the children and adults who have eczema can scratch anywhere, depending on where there's the most worst involvement in terms of eczematous skin. Although areas of the skin that are not openly involved with eczema may have some of the underlying immune reactions, so they can scratch anywhere. Trying to localize whether it's more a particular circumstance is more associated with itch on the scalp as opposed to itch on the trunk or itch on the extremities. That's very hard to do, I think.
Dr. Peter Smith?
Yeah, I would say that there are lots of things that can really trigger the itch response. In addition to those that Dr. Rosenwasser mentioned, in a number of medical conditions, for example, liver failure, renal failure, patients tend to have generalized itching all over. And we think that may be related to the fact that there are certain toxins being built up. In addition, if individuals receive a dose of morphine, they can oftentimes show a generalized itch response as well. Whether or not this is central or peripheral, we really don't understand that well at this point in time. The thing about itch is there's a very strong emotional component to it. So when you have an area that you really want to scratch, it feels really good when you scratch it. And actually, people can scratch to the point where they will cause open lesions to occur. You would never do this normally if you didn't have an itch. So it becomes really self-mutilation at some level. Turns out the itching pathway can actually turn off the pain-sensing pathway. So you can override that protective system and, in fact, do some damage to yourself as well. And finally, it's also something that is very much involved in some pattern behavior. For example, people with OCD will have scratch reflexes as well, or patterns of behavior. And in some ways, it's a lot like yawning. When you see somebody else scratch, you want to scratch too.
The contagious itch.
The contagious itch.
Yeah. More than 15 million people in the U.S. have symptoms of eczema. I am one of them. And I've definitely scratched myself into painful situations and wondered, why am I doing this? Why can't I stop? And wondered what's going on in my brain to let myself keep doing this. Do you have any response to that, Peter Smith? Help me.
Yeah, I do. It's, again, people have done studies where they have looked at the triggers that initiate scratch. And typically these are done by taking a patient and setting them up for imaging, MRIs, for example, and injecting a small amount of histamine under the skin and seeing what areas light up. And as you might expect, you have to perceive the itch. It has to go to a motor area where you set up a decision to scratch and you set up the motor patterns. But it also goes to this old area called the limbic system, which is all your emotional coloration. And there you can see that when you're needing to scratch, areas light up that would be associated with pain in some cases. And when you actually go ahead and start scratching, those areas tend to diminish in activity, indicating that you've done something to bring in a pleasant stimulus.
This is Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Suzanne Hogan. We're going to take your calls at 816-235-2888 to offer some relief. Rich in Overland Park, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. Well, first of all, I've observed people, a particular person, who itched uncontrollably, and it's a very, very unpleasant thing for them to do. I saw it. And this person went to a dermatologist, and the dermatologist suggested that this person take carbon pills, granulated carbon. Can you comment on that as a possibility? And I just take my answer off here.
Thank you, Rich.
I'm not aware of carbon as being a way of approaching this. Now, there is a very strong relationship between some types of dermatitis and diet, for example. So it may be that by taking activated carbon that you're able to pull out some of the unwanted substances, but that's the first I've heard of it.
Dr. Lanny Rosenwasser, when a person goes to see somebody about an itch, what are some of the common things that a doctor is going to look at and try to figure out to give them the proper diagnosis? Because it seems like there's just so many things that could be causing irritation.
I think any doctor who starts an evaluation of a patient with itch has to go through the entire list of things that we've been talking about, ranging from allergic and immunologic through metabolic issues in terms of liver and kidney function that Dr. Smith alluded to. So, taking a good history to try and pinpoint where you think this circumstance might be is the way to go. I'd just like to make two very quick points about some things. I didn't hear the caller's question that well, but activated carbon is sometimes used in individuals who have severe food allergy and anaphylaxis, and then when they get an accidental ingestion of shrimp, for example, or peanut, if you can catch them early on, activated charcoal can neutralize some of the allergens in patients with severe food allergy and anaphylaxis. So I know that it's been utilized in that circumstance, not as a general treatment for general itch, as far as I know, but in that circumstance, it works. And in the most severe, moderately severe to severe cases of eczema, itch, as you described earlier, is a very important issue, and a lot of damage to the skin can occur even in sleep when itch occurs. So in children with eczema, sometimes they're allowed to go to sleep with gloves on and other sorts of circumstances that might cut down on the degree in which the scratching might occur. And that quality of life issue, I think, is what may be driving the possibility for getting some of these biotech-based antibodies to either natriuretic hormone or peptide or things like interleukin-1. It's the relief and potential improvement in quality of life in patients who have severe clinical syndromes where there's itch and the possibility of real poor quality of life.
We're going to take another call from Dave in Overland Park. Dave, welcome to Central Standard.
Good morning. I just wanted to give you a little bit of insight. I was camping one time and got an incredibly bad case of poison oak on my back, and it was so bad that I wasn't able to work. Well, my doctor realized that I was basically broke at the time and I couldn't afford fancy prescriptions. So what he told me to do was to treat it with hot compresses and even Bengay. And what it did was that it fooled the nerve endings into believing that it was a heat response rather than an itch response, and I was sweating a lot, but at least I was able to function. And the doctor said that as long as it's something that's affecting your skin, you know, as from the outside as opposed to something you've ingested like a food allergy, that this will work 90% of the time.
Dave, thanks for the call. Peter Smith, does this make sense about what's going on in our brains, kind of tricking them to think that something else is going on?
The nerves that mediate the itch response contain a number of proteins that we call channels, and they are involved in determining the excitability of those nerve fibers. And there is a lot of crossover in terms of the responses to heat, responses to itch, responses to pain. So by using something like Bengay, which has, I believe, menthol and other aromatics in there, they actually interact with some of the channels on the nerves, and they can activate alternative pathways and sometimes even suppress activity within a given pathway. Another example would be, for example, the hot ingredient in chili pepper. something called capsaicin, which you can buy over the counter for a number of allergic issues, even post-herpetic neuralgia. You can treat with this particular compound as well. And so that can also modulate the itch response.
This is a pretty popular time for poison ivy, poison oak. Dr. Lani Rosenwasser at Children's Mercy Hospital, what are things that people can do besides avoiding the plants to help treat these rashes that can really take over?
Once they're established, it's essentially a contact sensitivity. The important thing is not to scratch if possible, because the urushiols that generate the reactions in poison oak and poison ivy can get on your fingers, and it's easy to spread them to other places in your body, including your face and your eyes. And in fact, they could be spread to other people that might be touched by these open sort of wounds with poison oak and poison ivy, etc. So avoiding that kind of process is reasonable. I might add, in addition to the neuropathic and neurogenic issues, that the issue of compresses and Bengay might generate that Professor Smith commented on. I believe Bengay also has salicylates in them. Might explain why there might have been some perspiration or sweating, since the salicylates can influence body temperature and sweating and may influence the amount of inflammation. In really bad poison oak and poison ivy, a short course of oral prednisone as an anti-inflammatory agent is generally a good idea to prevent it from having excessive symptoms or being spread to other parts of the body or to other individuals, as I mentioned. So it's a serious problem, and it can be dealt with in that kind of way.
So itching can be caused by so many things, and we alluded to this earlier. It can also be related to certain psychological conditions, stress and anxiety. Dr. Peter Smith, are you able to talk about that? Have people who have other psychological things that are going on, and itching becomes a relief for them.
Right. And I think it's, again, it's involved in this stereotypic behavior that people can sometimes get into. It is an activity that has a reward to it at some level, so it can be self-reinforcing in that regard. So I think it's very easy when people get perplexed, they scratch their heads. It's a sort of a standard stereotype behavior. It's, you know, people walk into rooms sometimes in uncertain situations, and scratching becomes something that they do just out of habit without even thinking about it. So I think there's a real psychological component in there that gives us some assurance in certain conditions.
What kind of treatment is there for people who are experiencing that?
There are situations, people who have intractable itching, there are a number, in addition to what Dr. Rosenwasser was talking about in terms of anti-inflammatories and things along that line, there are some people who have intractable itching, and there are things that along the lines of anti-epileptics and antidepressants that can help them.
So we're learning about itching today, but there's still so much that we don't really know about why we scratch itches and why we can scratch ourselves into a mess. What do we know about research that's going on right now to further create better understanding of itching?
Well, yeah, I have to take that. There is, well, as I mentioned earlier, we just, within the last 6 months, came to the point where we understand the pathway that's involved in mediating itch. And you'd think we've known about itch for, you know, thousands of years, obviously. It was defined first about 350 years ago as a phenomenon. But we're now just beginning to understand the pathways involved. And we think we know everything about medicine that we need to know. There's actually a lot we don't understand at all. At this point, having had those observations, engineering small molecules that can go in there and block the natriuretic peptide pathway we talked about earlier would be great. There's also another set of neurons that take the signal a little further to the brain that is something called a gastrin-releasing peptide. So now understanding the way that the neurons in this pathway talk to each other gives us immense power in being able to find ways that we can modulate, either prevent or downregulate the amount of activity in these pathways.
I have time for just one last question. Do we know why, when we talk about things like itching and scratching, and some of our listeners may be experiencing it this first half hour, that it can cause that sensation to feel that that tingling feeling? Do you know why talking about itching makes us want to scratch?
Well, my opinion of that is that we are very suggestible individuals. that, again, it's something, it's a behavior that has some benefit to it, and that we are, just like with yawning, we tend to pick up on other people's signaling at that point.
Dr. Lanny Rosenwasser?
Yeah, no, I think a lot of the research has focused on the peripheral aspects because they're easier to measure, and we can look at the molecules and small molecules and immune activities and histamine and cytokines that might be playing a role. And, you know, utilizing any kind of strategy to interdict any of those things I think will be helpful. What we don't know much about is what happens at the central part of the nervous system, and what you're talking about is conscious suggestion in influencing a pathway that might be the same pathways that get activated from below in terms of pain or itch or triggering with the molecules we mentioned. So knowing exactly how in the CNS the brain activates that part would be very, very interesting. There have been studies in asthma where allergens are placed into the airway in asthmatic individuals, and you can demonstrate that there are changes in the brain in these asthmatics via fMRI that are specifically associated with some of the effects due to mediators in the lung. So it's entirely possible that there's a connection between the CNS and these peripheral events that might be involved, and the suggestion that you can say something might trigger the same kind of pathways at the CNS level. We certainly have a lot to learn, and it's a very interesting area, no question.
That's Dr. Lanny Rosenwasser, Professor of Pediatrics at Children's Mercy Hospital. We are also joined by Dr. Peter Smith, a neuroscientist and director for the Institute of Neurological Discoveries based at KU Medical Center. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
We have to take a break. Now we're rotating neurologists. Just ahead, neurologists from the same institutions as Dr. Smith and Rosenwasser, who specialize in migraine research and treatments. I'm Suzanne Hogan. Central Standard returns in just a moment. This is Central Standard. I'm Suzanne Hogan. In the U.S., over 30 million people suffer from migraines, nearly 10% of the population. A headache of throbbing, pulsating pain, visual phenomena, sensitivity to light, sound, nausea, vomiting, problems with speech. 91% of migraine sufferers have to miss work or can't function normally during an attack. 70% of migraine sufferers are women. Despite all these facts and the research about migraines, there's still so much that is unknown. This is Central Standard. I'm Suzanne Hogan. Our guests today are both doctors who are working hard researching to find out more about this mysterious headache. Dr. Jennifer Bickle, neurologist and medical director of Children's Mercy Headache Clinic. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
And Nancy Berman, a member of the Institute for Neurological Discoveries based at KU Medical Center. Nancy, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So I just listed off all these statistics, and you find all these things, statistics about migraines. But then when you dig a little deeper, we find out that we still just don't know that much. Let's start with what are the symptoms and then get into what we don't know. Dr. Jennifer Bickle?
Yeah, so first of all, there are many type of headaches, but the headache that's going to make someone go to the doctor most frequently is going to be migraine headaches. And as you already mentioned, that these headaches typically have a tendency to be more severe. Now, they don't have to be emergency room severe, but severe enough to interfere with someone's ability to function. It has a tendency to be a one-sided headache, throbbing. It can be worse with even just simple movements such as walking up the stairs or bending over. And it can also be associated with nausea, vomiting, light and noise sensitivity. And some of the times, about 15% of the time, an individual can have an aura. An aura is a neurological symptom that can be either visual changes, but it can also be pretty severe to the point of paralysis on half the body.
Wow. You work with children at Children's Mercy
Yes.
Hospital. The first time a child experiences a headache like this, what is that like for them, and how do parents deal with that?
I think it's certainly a very scary situation. So much of what I try to do is to let parents know that even though their child is in severe pain, their child is not in danger. But that goes against our gut instinct, right? Severe pain means danger. So, of course, everybody's afraid in those situations. But a lot of times going through and walking through the symptoms of what it is and showing how treatment can help is often effective.
Are children able to, I guess, explain what's going on in a way that explains these symptoms, or does it take some digging?
You know, The word I always look for is if a parent says that their child acts like a hermit during that time, like that they go into a cave, because a lot of times they won't notice the light and noise sensitivity. They'll just notice that their child withdraws from the environment. Because of the prominent vomiting that it can occur, especially with children, a lot of times it gets misdiagnosed as repeated stomach infections, as if they just keep getting a stomach bug.
So we still don't know a lot about what causes migraines. What do we know what does at all?
Well, in the research field, there's a lot of interest in whether the migraine is caused by having something wrong with your brain or whether it's something more like an allergy that's reaction that could be somewhere in the coverings of your brain. That's something that starts in the periphery. And there's sort of two camps about that. And most of the people in the field have this feeling that if you have migraine, there's something wrong with your brain. But the problem with that, at least from my point of view, is that there's this phenomenon called neuroplasticity. And people in the neuroscience field usually think of that as a good thing. That's the thing that allows you to recover from a stroke or allows you to get better after you've had any kind of injury. But it really just means that the brain is plastic and changes in response to what happens. If you have chronic pain, if you have something like migraine, that changes your brain. And of course, they find changes in the brain with people with migraine, but they don't know whether that's a cause or an effect of it. So actually, in my research, I've been working with hormones because we know what they are and we can use them experimentally. And the issue that I've been interested in is the three times as many women as men have it, and it occurs during reproductive years, that's after puberty and before menopause, and how estrogen might be a trigger for migraine and how that actually works. So.
Dr. Nancy Berman, as you said, you've been researching this and you decided to focus on women. Mostly, I read that there hasn't been a lot of focus just on women, and that was part of the reason why you wanted to really dig in and focus on women.
So that's true of every field in science over the last 50 years. Probably over 90% or more of all the research money has been spent either to study men or male rats and mice and animal models. It's only in the last few years that the issue of sex differences has become a topic of research in every field, no matter what it is. When people start to look into it, there are very large sex differences. So not just migraine, but you know, even infectious diseases and every sort of disease there are sex differences. So
what are the things that are going on in women's brains that you're finding that are helping along with the research?
So I've actually started out in the periphery, not so much in the brain. What I've been doing is looking at estrogen receptors. So if estrogen is a cause, wherever it causes something is where the receptors are. And just very basic things. There are estrogen receptors in the pain cells, the ones that carry pain information from the face or covering of the brain into the brain. And there are estrogen receptors in the brain. And which cells are they in and how does that change any sort of ongoing pain condition? And can they be triggered by things other than estrogen? So,
How do you go about testing something like estrogen receptors?
Well, you can take the cells out and grow them in a dish and look to see if the protein that's an estrogen receptor is there and add estrogen to the dish and see if that changes what proteins the cells make, all the way to doing behavioral studies and with animals that have estrogen and other ones that don't and seeing if that changes their behaviors.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Suzanne Hogan. We're talking about migraine headaches. Do you suffer from migraines? Is there anything that you do to help manage them? Give us a call at 816-235-2888, 816-235-2888, or you can post your experience and insights to Facebook. And Dr. Jennifer Bickle with Children's Mercy Headache Clinic, you've been doing a lot of research with children, and have you been having them keep a diary as part of monitoring how they're progressing over
time? You know,
there
are some specialists that believe very much in the headache diary. One of the issues that I just have with it is that sometimes with the children that are having chronic daily headaches, I actually want them to focus on their headaches less. So I'm trying to keep their headaches from not being their entire identity. So typically when I think that the diary is most important is when I'm trying to get a better idea of frequency or severity of school attendance, of medications being used. But headache diaries, though, might be able to be useful for headache triggers. What can be hard about that, though, is when you take a headache trigger, let's say something such as nitrates, which is found in hot dogs and sometimes thought to trigger a migraine. The issue is that if the child did not sleep well the night before and is stressed, then perhaps the hot dog, the nitrite, would be enough to trigger a headache. But a hot dog by itself doesn't. It's usually a combination of triggers that occurs that can lead to the headache. And so for that reason, I usually feel that I try to do more overall lifestyle recommendations.
Like what?
Generally, I like to keep sleep cycles within about the same hour. For example, if you go to sleep at 9 during the week, go to sleep by 10 on the weekend. You know, I feel that a lot of times when a child ends up sleeping till 1 or 2 in the afternoon, then has to get up for school Monday morning, it's just often going to trigger a migraine. Weather changes are often going to be, let me put it this way, stress and weather changes have been shown consistently to be the top two causes of headaches, or top two triggers of headaches, I guess I should say. So we try to identify, well, of course we can't change the weather, but we do try to identify some of what those stressors might be, or provide breathing techniques or other skills that can help address those.
So once you're able to understand what your triggers are, mm-hmm. what are things that people can do to try to, I guess, keep their migraine from getting to be so powerful?
Well, I think one of the things is, you know, if you talk about a specific migraine attack, as we kind of alluded to earlier, just knowing that you're not in danger can help your body to calm down. In addition to use the medicines early, the truth is that our medicines don't work that well once the headache is severe. And a lot of us want to wait until the headache is really bad before we take a medicine. But the truth is they work the best if you take it at the earliest onset. Usually, especially in the cases of children, just to be able to give them 20 minutes in a dark, quiet room, a little bit of Motrin, maybe even a little caffeine, can be very effective in helping to stop that headache.
What are some of the side effects of some of these medications? Do some people suffer more from them and find that they just don't really work for them?
One of the issues is that when you look at any of what we call the abortive medicines, the medicines that are used to stop a headache, is that they were all made to be used about 4 times a month. That's actually when they're most effective. But the issue is, though, is that if someone ends up having more frequent headaches, especially what we refer to as chronic daily headaches, when they have more than 15 days of headaches a month, those medicines just stop working. They're being used too frequently. In addition to it, there are certain medicines, especially things such as narcotics or another medicine that's called Furanil, Furoset, that if used on a frequent basis, anywhere between 5 to 8 days a month, can actually start to make headaches worse and occur more frequently. So what I would recommend for most people is if they find that they're having to use a medicine to stop their headache more than once a week, they should really seek a healthcare provider.
What's the most common age that people start to experience migraines? I mean, there are definitely kids that, you know, start at a younger age, but there's a later onset as well.
Right. So when you look at the numbers, a real basic way that I like to talk about it is about 5% of 5-year-olds, about 10% of 10-year-olds, and about 15% of 15-year-olds. But one of the issues is that boys and girls will have the same incidence of migraine up until the age of puberty, and that's going to be about the 10%. But after that time, after puberty, girls start to get much more frequent migraines, and this is where the hormonal component comes in that Dr. Berman was talking about.
Are there triggers that are different for adults with their hormonal cycles as they get older?
So there's a phenomenon called menstrual migraine, and it's an interesting thing because it seems like you have to have estrogen in your body to get the migraine, but when you get the attack is when that estrogen falls. So it seems to be changes in estrogen more than estrogen levels, and during menstruation, your estrogen levels fall, and that is often the trigger for an attack. But that also means that if you do any sort of birth control that involves hormones, if you have a level that's not constant, that rising and falling, that can trigger headaches. And some of the worst are actually during menopause when hormone levels will rise and fall a lot. But in many cases, after menopause, the patients get better. So constant at a low level or in late pregnancy, constant at a high level seem to make it better. Anytime when it's changing a lot, that's when it's worse.
And one thing I just want to say from a clinical standpoint is that we definitely see the hormonal influence on migraines. But testing for hormones, you know, that's a question I get a lot. So should I do testing to see if my hormones are abnormal? That's not the case. The way that I like to explain it is that it's normal hormones. It's the normal fluctuations that we see in hormones. It's the brain that's responding abnormally to them. So hormone testing is not necessarily going to be beneficial. But sometimes if someone's getting a menstrual migraine every month, using a continuous birth control pill for 3 months to eliminate those fluctuations in the hormones that Dr. Berman was referencing can be helpful.
This is Central Standard on KCUR. We're going to take a call from Phil in Overland Park. He called 816-235-2888, 816-235-2888. Phil, welcome to the program.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Doctor, thank you so much for taking my call. I'm one of the lucky men who get migraines. I realize the majority of migraines are women, and maybe your research just deals with that. But I've had them since I was 12, 13 years old. I've discovered two things. As you said, I've sensitized myself to when they're coming. And I get that aura in the eye. And if I take two aspirin right away, it usually takes care of it. But once that headache gets going, if I have to delay taking the aspirin, it's, you know, stay up all night and sick to stomach and everything else. So, again, I just over the years have become sensitized to it. And you can tell me, I don't know if this is bogus or I'm crazy, but a friend of mine in the Army was a neurologist, and he said, get in a quiet place, visualize sitting in front of a campfire like your hands are terribly, terribly hot, mm-hmm. and that will lessen the severity. Well, I was a high school teacher. I could not do that. But what I found is if I physically did it, if I filled a sink full of water as hot as I could stand it, immersed my hands, it lessens the severity of the headache by, I bet, 60 to 80%. It'll be gone within an hour.
You know, it's interesting.
Does it sound bogus?
Actually, I got to tell you that it actually makes sense to me on two different points. The first point is that the neurologist who originally recommended for you to envision warming your hands was trying to introduce you to what's called biofeedback. So we actually have a biofeedback clinic at Children's Mercy that we use on a frequent basis to be able to help to manage headaches. Biofeedback essentially is being able to control your body's response to the environment, such as the temperature of your hand, your heart rate, sweating on a microscopic level, et cetera. But what you're actually doing, I would not call biofeedback per se, you know, but the whole thing about the way the pain system works is if you're able to give yourself an alternative sensation, you can decrease pain. For example, that a lot of times people will find that rubbing their head can help with their headaches, or they'll find that vibration can help with their headaches. As a matter of fact, for some adults who have chronic refractory pains, they'll put in stimulators, which is essentially chronic vibration. If you can give your body a different sensation, that will it will often decrease pain. It's, for example, why we rub our toe after we stub it.
But Phil, thank you so much for calling in. Children's Mercy uses a multidisciplinary approach. Could you talk a little bit about what that means?
Yeah, so typically when someone goes to see a neurologist, it's going to involve education about headaches, testing if necessary, which, by the way, testing is usually not necessary. And typically medications that, if needed, can be used to help prevent headache or can be used to help stop a headache. But sometimes there are individuals whose headaches don't get better with a conventional approach or are having a large degree of disability. You know those children I was mentioning earlier that have the chronic daily headaches? Some of them have gotten to the point where they no longer attend school. And so the multidisciplinary clinic is myself, along with a pain psychologist, a PhD pain psychologist, massage therapy, strong nursing support. And when the individual comes in, they see all of us and actually spend half a day there as we try to work on lifestyle changes, breathing techniques, and getting someone back in school is usually going to be one of our first and foremost goals.
What does migraine testing look like? You said that it's not always necessary to do it. Is it an invasive process?
No, so there is no test for migraine. And I think that, well, I can pretty much say that I know that if we had a test for migraine, people would be treated quicker and there'd be less stress involved with it. But the truth is that the only reason for testing in the situation of headaches is if you're concerned the headache is secondary to something else. We refer to headaches as primary or secondary. When someone has a headache, 95% of the time it's primary, meaning that it's due to the pathways acting inappropriately. 5% of the time it might be secondary to something, and that's when we get concerned about things like tumors or aneurysms. We actually have very good evidence on how to be able to tell if someone has a serious cause just based on talking to a patient and examining them. So MRIs, blood work are often not necessary. Now, sometimes they are, but they're often not.
We're going to take a call from Don in Independence. Don, welcome to Central Standard.
Yes, I just have a comment. I'm a very allergic individual. I've never had migraines, but I go to the Office of Environmental Medicine, which is another field of allergy, and allergies do cause migraines. They can be allergic related, and that's just my comment.
Dr. Nancy Berman?
So in response to an allergen, there is a chemical that's released that can cause your blood vessels to dilate. And that happens whether it's in your skin, even your hands, or around your brain. This is a major target for drug company development now. And blocking that response improves migraines. So there was a drug that was developed by Merck that almost made it to the market, but then it caused some liver problems that blocks that response. And now there's another company is developing the same target but a different chemical to try to block it, and they have hopes that that will eventually come to the market. So the same response that would cause your hands to turn red if you rub chili pepper on them is involved in headache. And that's a hope for one of the future treatments that in maybe 10 years from now will be available. So you're right.
I'm wondering, how much discrimination do migraine sufferers face? A lot of times pain keeps people from being able to go to work. Miss social functions, it's hard on relationships. Yeah. Can you speak about experiences with patients that you've come across?
So I don't see patients, but I follow the literature, and there's actually been a really interesting recent study by Dr. Bob Shapiro at University of Vermont. Just did a questionnaire. If one of your coworkers had allergy, had migraine, had panic disorder, had epilepsy, would you be more or less likely to invite them to a party? And he found a very high level of discrimination against people with migraine. And so people who have it don't speak out, and that's part of the reason that there hasn't been as much funding for research as there has for other conditions like asthma. But actually recently, someone very brave has come forward to speak out, sort of like Mary Tyler Moore did on behalf of diabetes, and has appeared at some of the fundraising events that the national organization does, and that's Cindy McCain. And if any of you ever seen her during some of the campaign stops, you may have noticed that she sometimes wears sunglasses. And the reason for that is that she has severe migraine, not that she's shy. So,
yeah, the headache advocacy groups for years have had difficulty getting anyone to step forward, you know, celebrities, et cetera, to step forward and say they have migraines because of the stigma associated with it. It's one of those conditions that people look at as, oh, well, you're just exaggerating a regular headache, or you've somehow done something to cause it yourself.
And then for children, do they face certain discriminations in school? I mean, you said they miss school and then maybe feel more isolated already on top of feeling in pain.
Exactly. And that's what really starts what I refer to as the downward spiral that can occur. Because once they've missed some school and then perhaps a teacher didn't believe them that they had a headache, or perhaps their friends don't believe them, then they start to get more anxious, and going back to school becomes harder and harder. That in turn makes more headaches. But yes, there's a definite stigma involved with it. Sometimes they're not allowed to make up homework. I think the entire thing with it is that it's not objective. None of us can look at someone and say, yes, you have a migraine. So if it's a child that already gets in trouble or doesn't do well in school, it's typically, well, not typically, but often assumed that they're just trying to get out of school.
We have an email from Bill. He wrote us at centralstandard@kcur.org. You can still give us a call at 816-235-2888. He says, migraines ruled my life to a great extent for years. I would plan ahead knowing I would have one. Mildren had started to become ineffective, ultimately a blood pressure medicine I started taking had a side effect that eliminated the migraines. I went from 1 to 2 a week to 1 to 2 in 20 years. You're nodding your heads.
Yes, exactly. So the issue with headaches, let me just put it this way, that there has been so little research done at a fundamental level that no medicine has ever come to market with the goal of preventing headaches. So what this means is that as headache specialists and neurologists, we have to use medicines that were discovered for other purposes, whether it be for blood pressure, seizure control, and we use them to help prevent headaches. And there are some very good studies that some blood pressure medicines can work to help prevent headaches.
Do people face issues with insurance companies when trying to pay for care related to their migraines?
Yes. One thing that we do know, you know, even just talking about that prevention, that if you're able to put someone on the right prevention, the amount of medical services they need decrease significantly. So when it comes to the insurance, one of the issues with it is kind of what I was referencing before, that there's no medicine that has been made specifically for headaches. So sometimes we have to use for off-label purposes, and the insurance companies might nix that.
What's the role of serotonin here, Dr. Nancy Berman?
Well, the pain cells have serotonin receptors, and when you activate those, you can reduce headaches. But serotonin receptors are everywhere. They're in the brain. They're in the gut. So it's just empirical. We know that these drugs work, but exactly why and how and even where the effect is, I'm not even certain whether the drug needs to get into the brain to be effective. So,
and what's interesting about it is that even some of our medications, the antidepressants, SSRIs, are not effective. Even the ones that are very specific towards serotonin are not effective for headache prevention. But the antidepressants that hit serotonin plus other receptors such as dopamine are effective. So it seems like we're usually talking about a multimodal approach that's needed.
We're almost out of time, but I'm wondering if two of you could give us some suggestions for listeners of where they can go for support or resources on where they can find more if they're suffering from a migraine.
Because, well, let me put it this way, there's a lot of bad information about headaches out there. So two good sites to go through are the American Headache Society and the National Headache Foundation. They will both have information on how to find local providers. In addition, they'll have reliable information.
And also the Migraine Research Foundation, migraineresearchfoundation.org. You can actually friend them on Facebook and they'll send you updates. So it's kind of interesting to see that. I do that and I'm interested to see what patients have to say.
Well, we're out of time. I want to thank Dr. Jennifer Bickel, neurologist and medical director of Children's Mercy Headache Clinic, and Nancy Berman, a member of the Institute for Neurological Discoveries based at KU Medical Center. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tune in tomorrow for Central Standard. We'll be looking at being biracial, and in the second half, we'll demystify nudism. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and myself, with help from Claire McInerney, Ross Steinmetz, and Sangeeta Shastri. Up to Date is next with Steve's Bookshelf. I'm Suzanne Hogan, and this is Central Standard on KCUR. Enjoy the day.